This is Karin Zissis of ASCOA Online. Forty-three days after a vote, at 10:30 at night on July 19th, Peru's national electoral body officially declared Pedro Castillo the winner of the presidential runoff. His rival, Keiko Fujimori, whose allegations of fraud delayed the certification, said she'll recognize the results. The United States and the EU, along with over a dozen electoral missions, all have said the voting was fair, with the State Department calling the election a model of democracy. But having his win made official is only the first of many hurdles that lie ahead for Castillo, a 51-year-old schoolteacher and union leader from Peru's northern Cajamarca region, and an outsider to the Lima-centered establishment. On the same day as the electoral body's announcement, my colleague, Holly Sunderland, spoke with Mitra Taj, an independent journalist and New York Times stringer who's been based in Peru for the last 8 years, as well as Peruvian legal expert Alonso Gormendi of Lima's Universidad del Pacífico and a PhD candidate at the University College London. They talked about Castillo's prospects in office, where he might be able to build bridges, and the opposition challenges that he'll need to contend with. Castillo takes office July 28th, when Peru will also celebrate its bicentennial. Here's the conversation.
You're listening to Latin America in Focus.
Latinoamérica en Foco.
América Latina en Foco.
A podcast by America Society, Council of the Americas, on politics, economics, and culture in the region.
Thank you both so much for talking with me today. We are officially in three different time zones. We have Alonso in London, Mitra is in Lima, I'm coming in from New York. First question, let's actually talk about Castillo's platform. We know he'll face a difficult scenario in Congress, but I want to look at, you know, these policies that people have rallied behind, both how pressing you guys see this need is for Peru right now, and how likely it is these proposals could be passed. So the first up, Castillo's hallmark proposal is to rewrite the Peruvian constitution via a constituent assembly.
I think the idea of changing the Peruvian constitution has been a constant in the Peruvian left ever since the 1993 constitution. But I don't think it has been a proposal that has been landed a lot. Like there's not a lot of specifics of this is what we want the constitution to look like. There's a lot of rhetoric. There's not a lot of concrete proposals. So I think the first obstacle is, well, it depends on how Castillo wants to move forward with this proposal. Because currently, right now, under Peruvian constitutional law, there are mechanisms through which you can change the Peruvian constitution in its entirety. But these are means that would likely be unavailable considering the composition of Congress right now. So Castillo is trying to find other ways to avoid having to go through the quote-unquote obstacle of Congress, which is where my concerns start, because if the idea is to create a constitution that is, unlike the 1993 constitution that is illegitimate to many, create a constitution that is perfectly legitimate for everyone, then the best alternative would be to follow the letter of the law, which is something that Castillo might not be able to do. And I feel like there's a bit of a sense in the Peruvian left where we did it and we need to take advantage of the fact that finally we have the president that we wanted to have. This is not going to be another Humala. He's not going to betray us midway. So we need to get things done because it's now or never. And I wish there was a little bit more of a feeling of, okay, we won, and let's have trust in the platform that we're presenting so that they can propose a more, you know, slow process, but more informed, that allows the population to digest what they are proposing specifically, kind of like what happened in Chile with the new constitution in Chile started to brew with Bachelet, and it's only now that it's taking the form of a constituent assembly. So give that time for the proposal to brew and to be accepted by the population. And I don't think that's what they're looking for. So I am expecting in a country with the institutions that it has, like Peru, where basically the president and the Congress have both a silver bullet to destroy the other one. The president can dissolve Congress and Congress can vacate the president. That is going to be where the crisis in Peru is going to stop being Trump right now in 2020, and it's going to become Dilma Rousseff in Brazil 2016, where she was, you know, impeached very shadily so, right? So, and I think the groundwork is being laid right now to argue that Castillo should be impeached, either because of he proposes a new constitution or because of the corruption accusations against his party.
So another big proposal is the idea that he might nationalize or at least kind of change the regulations regarding mining and gas. Mitra, what are your thoughts on that? Like, how likely do you think it could happen, or how might it happen in part?
I mean, I think he's been ambiguous enough about it, or inconsistent enough about it while campaigning and also since the election, that he's not really going to be maybe tied down to any kind of particular promise and might have some leeway for doing something much more moderate, which appears to be maybe the direction he's going in. I don't think it's that, you know, it's that radical to really raise taxes on mining companies. I think that's something that will probably happen. It's actually something that Keiko's campaign, somebody from Keiko's campaign had told me that they were also planning to do, to kind of raise taxes on excess profit, or whatever you want to call it, kind of unusually large profits by mining companies and others. So that's probably going to happen. It's something I think the executive will be able to do on its own. They also, I think another thing that he's talked about is renegotiating contracts with a limited number of mining companies that were given these contracts that locked in the tax rate at a certain time. That kind of increase wouldn't be allowed to happen unless they renegotiate those contracts. So I would think if it's done in the right way, those are things that would happen, unless it just becomes so politically chaotic, I think, or his government is just so unstable that he can't even kind of get started on those or follow through with them. So, you know, but those are direct negotiations with companies, which it'll depend on the will of the company and also the government to see what comes out of that. I don't think there's really any other way to force it without changing the constitution. So, and on economic policy, I feel like it's just so hard to predict what his government's going to be like, because there's been so much back and forth, and we're like less than 10 days away from when he's going to be taking office, and we still don't know who the prime minister is. Not even, we don't know who the prime minister is going to be. We don't know like what shade of left, you know, this government's going to be. I mean, the fact that they're talking about, you know, Alonso Segura, a former finance minister of Humala, very orthodox, I think probably widely considered as competent minister in terms of managing the macroeconomic stuff in Peru. I mean, that he's being talked about as a possible minister is just, it's surprising, but it's happening. And that's very different from Pedro Franque, Vero's economic advisor. But there's been, you know, two other people before that. So who knows? Who knows? I don't feel like I have any clue what it's going to be like beyond a few general promises to make sure that the country's natural resources are used better, you know, benefit Peruvians more broadly. And there's a change in the constitution to give the state a greater role in managing the economy or determining economic policy.
I actually agree with Mitra that there's a lot of uncertainty. There is the one canary in the coal mine that I saw that, I mean, the canary is still alive, being CONFIEP, the Association of Businesses. This is an organization that is politically oriented, that they issue statements, and they are very, you know, libertarian oriented, very pro Fujimori, and they haven't really participated in this slow coup, to use the words of Marcos Cifuentes, by Keiko's forces, at least not to the degree that I would have anticipated, which leads me to suspect that there is some level of expectation on the very wealthy business community that they can either surf the waves, or that whatever approaches Castillo makes, they're willing to accommodate him to some level, because they didn't jump into the let's get rid of Castillo wagon. And that, to me, that does send a signal of, okay, things are not exploding completely just yet, because otherwise they would have, I think.
Who are some other figures who, if maybe not, they might not be named to his cabinet, who are the other figures in his orbit? And Julio Velarde is obviously a huge figure. He's been Peru's central bank president since 2006, internationally recognized as one of the best central bank presidents in the world. What is the latest that we know on Castillo's kind of temperature towards him? And again, who are sort of the other names in his orbit right now that we're hearing?
I think the fact that he, you know, announced that he wanted Julio Velarde to stay on was kind of the biggest signal that, you know, that he wanted to send to investors and markets in general that it's going to be okay. And I think if you add up the different signals or his different things that he's done since the election, they all kind of go in that direction. I mean, again, the fact that he's kind of weighing between Alonso Segura and Franke, that's probably a relief for a lot of investors. Franke has been doing a lot of talking with different business groups or business leaders to kind of reassure them, talk about things that may come. So Velarde said that he would consider it. I mean, he didn't rule it out at all. He was very respectful and said that, you know, we're going to talk more after he's proclaimed president. He seemed to talk about that as a given. So I think on the economic side, that's it doesn't look like it's going to change that much. I think we're probably going to have Franke and we're probably going to have Velarde. If they can talk him into staying, maybe there's just a transition thing of a year or so. But I mean, I think Umalo was able to talk him into staying, and I think Castillo probably will too. The prime minister post is kind of strange because Castillo's press person, he threw out that, you know, among the names being considered for prime minister is Roger Najar, who's a former congressman. He's somebody he's a politician who's not that well known and is closer to Cerrón, I think, than most people would like. Cerrón is the Marxist-Leninist leader. Of the biggest relief for the right, for the center, would be for Castillo, and for many on the left, for Castillo to completely distance himself from Cerrón in some way. But if he ends up naming Najar, I think, as prime minister, that would not be something that goes in that direction. So it's kind of like one day you hear this, another day you hear that. There hasn't been anything really that consistent on those things. So it's hard to predict.
I mean, I don't have any names, but I do think that there might be a lesson in what happened. He was a novice in politics, but he did go through a lot of politicking when he was a union leader. And what we saw in that is, I mean, this is where all the accusations that he's a member of the Shining Path comes from. I don't like giving credence to those accusations, because how I see that is not that he is, you know, the next Abimael Guzmán, but that he was a person with political ambition who saw an opportunity to get a big position in a big union by, you know, allying himself, positioning himself with some unsavory characters. And he was able to, you know, say, okay, you need a non-Movadef, non-Shining Path face to promote your new candidacy for the presidency of this union. Okay, I'm your guy. If you can juggle Movadef and the Shining Path, you can juggle Peruvian politics. So I'm hoping that that lesson has its negatives, because it means that his red lines are very non-existent. Like, he's willing to work with anyone, including Cerrón, including Movadef. But at the same time, he is able to push forward in complicated scenarios, and he might be able to do some surprising alliances to produce what he wants. Let's just hope that what he wants is democratic and, you know, and responsible economically.
And it's worth pointing out that also during the teacher strike, he also met with humoristas at Congress. I
mean, no red lines.
So let's say, you know, he is confirmed, he does take office. We know he faces a difficult scenario in Congress. His party has the most number of seats, but no party, there are, I think, 10 of them in the incoming session. No party is anywhere close to a majority, and the party composition as a whole is going to lean right. So where do we see opportunities for him to maybe build coalitions, or on what issues?
I mean, the thing that he has in common with his rival in the campaign was that they were both social conservatives. So that's kind of maybe some common ground. There was a big backlash against this kind of gender equality stuff that the government was trying to put in curriculum. And that's kind of, there's just a whole world of activism against anything related to sex education, abortion, women's rights, that kind of thing. So I don't think there's much to be done there. But he does, what he has going for him is that he's going to be president. And I think any president, he's got control of the government. I think there's lawmakers that are going to want to get some things done for their constituents. And that's going to require working with the government to some degree. But I think this is the first time we're going to have lawmakers in Congress that might not even recognize the president as legitimate. That's, you know, that he won by stealing an election. And that's going to just make everything much, much harder. That might force him to rely more on, it's going to be harder for him, I think, to distance himself from Cerrón, the head of his party, because of that. If he's not going to be able to work with centrist or the right or anybody else in Congress, he's going to be stuck relying on the 35 lawmakers in Perú Libre. And most of them are controlled or seen as controlled by Cerrón and not Castillo. But again, this hard line opposition to him is going to, I think, force him to also kind of resort to relying on support from other leftists much more than if it weren't the case. But I think he will, as time goes by, he might find some centrist support in Congress. You know, lawmakers here aren't exactly disciplined in terms of there's not a lot of party discipline. we're probably going to see a lot of people just abandoning their parties in the first few months.
Mm-hmm. I know one of the reforms that was able to be passed in the last few years is Congress people can no longer be reelected. So they really only have their 1 5-year shot to make something happen. And so if they feel this is their, you know, one time to do something, then yeah, maybe they do kind of go for whatever opportunities might arise.
Yeah, I mean, on the one hand, I have some hope for Castillo, the pragmatic, if you will. I hope that he can achieve the kind of like social structure transformation that Evo Morales did for Bolivia, where he empowered people that were disenfranchised and unempowered. I hope he can do that without falling into the more authoritarian tendencies that Morales showed towards the end. So on that, I am hopeful that would be a sort of like a left-leaning government that Peru has needed for a while now. We would be lucky if that's the case. I don't know. I can't guarantee. But at the same time, I'm very concerned at this self-fulfilling prophecy that the right is constructing, where they are approaching Castillo as an enemy to defeat and doing exactly the opposite to what Confiep is doing. Right? Confiep is staying silent, saying, okay, approach us and we will talk and we'll see. Right. Whereas Vargas Llosa, Keiko, Cordoba, all of these people are convinced that this is the start of the dictatorship. And so Castillo is going to go into the presidency knowing that there is already groundwork being laid for him to be impeached. And so he will not be able to approach Congress from a centrist perspective and collaborate. He's going to need to depend on his own Congress people. And as you said, they lean Cerrón. So what the right is doing is pushing Castillo towards a confrontational starting position. And so they are creating their own monster. And I think that is my biggest fear, that we end up with kind of like what happened with PPK, only without a PPK there, but Castillo that has, you know, a lot more experience with social mobilization and, you know, protests and something that he hasn't done so far. Like, I was expecting 10,000 ronderos in the middle of Lima at some point to protest.
Also, this is not to be cynical, but looking at the last 5 years, I mean, Peru had 4 presidents in one term. 2 were forced out by Congress. 1 resigned after a week of unrest and fatal protests. And then the last one, Francisco Sagasti, is serving out on an interim basis. So, you know, the talk of the president being removed from office, I don't want to put odds on it, but like, how likely is it, or what would be the available mechanisms?
I mean, I think looking at what's happened just since the last elections, it's not at all unreasonable to think that both Congress is probably going to try and impeach him. And he will probably use what they call the cuestión de confianza, kind of a constitutional clause that allows his government to bring a vote of confidence vote on a particular matter. So he can use that if they vote no twice, he can then dissolve Congress. So I don't think it's unreasonable to think that both of those things will be tried at the least, because they were unusual before the last election. But as we saw, I mean, just in the past few years, how many times impeachment was kind of used. And also, I mean, dissolving Congress is not that unusual, and it is considered constitutional right of the president in those cases. But, you know, using it kind of just because you want to force Congress to do something, I don't think was the original idea either. So Vizcarra's dissolution of Congress was considered constitutional in that case, but to kind of turn it into a way of resolving a dispute is far from ideal. So I don't think it's really that speculative to talk about this as something that will likely happen. My personal sense is that I think the military is going to be very important, and I think protesters are going to be very important. I think we've seen in the last, not just what happened with Merino in November in terms of protests bringing down the president, but, you know, the past, since I've been here, actually, there's kind of been an increase in activism and protests by young people that have done things. They've managed to change policies or get politicians to go back on something they've done that was very controversial. So those, I think both the public and the military is going to be kind of key to determining likely constitutional crises that are going to come. It's unfortunate, but I you know, this is what happens when institutions are pushed to their limits. You end up with crises and violence, essentially, or the threat of violence is what can determine things.
I agree with what Mitra has said. I would add to that the social component, the symbolism of who Castillo is and what that would do to the protests and to the reactions to any attempt at getting rid of him. It would attack the very fiber of the country. Are we a country of Lima, or are we a country of the Andes? And that is kind of unrest that I don't want to see. I am very scared of drawing lines on ethnic backgrounds, basically, which is something that is already being affirmed by, you know, the Vargas Llosas and there's a lot of division being proposed here. And I think it's inevitable that Congress is going to try to impeach, vacate Castillo on the accusations of the fact that the Dinámicos del Centro, this mafia at the heart of the Cerrón administration in Junín, have financed his campaign. That is definitely going to be brought up very fast. And I think, sadly, because I do think there is a different, you know, Marvel timeline where the right stops doing this and starts approaching Castillo more responsibly and not as an enemy that needs to be removed, but as a potential partner, where things end up going a lot better. But I do think that in our timeline, what's going to happen is that it's going to be a race to see who gets to do what first. Does Castillo get his two denials of confidence first and solves Congress, or does Congress get to vacate him first? With the added danger, I would say that the original proposal for changing the constitution by the Serronistas was to replace Congress with a constituent assembly. So picture yourself in a scenario where Castillo gets his two refusals and he dissolves Congress. And instead of calling for elections for a new Congress, he replaces it with the constituent assembly that he would like to convene as soon as possible. That would be a democratic crisis. That would be a very serious problem that would probably be not accepted by Congress, who would start sessioning, you know, in parallel probably. And then there you have, you know, a Venezuela situation that no one wants, right? So I do implore the people who do not like Castillo to be a little bit more intelligent in their approach to who clearly is someone they oppose, and they have every right to oppose him, but I mean, both democratically and more intelligently.
Mm-hmm. Now, let's go, because again, we've mentioned at different times, you know, people compare Castillo very quickly to Chavez. There are some other parallels to Morales. Where do you guys see Castillo? He does share similarities with maybe some of these other leftist regional leaders. And where do you see distinctions?
I mean, I don't see him as ideological as either of them. He's far from being as popular as either of them was when they won elections and when they started to do the reforms that they did. I think we haven't really seen him in a leadership role yet. I think once he's in office, we might get a better sense of whether he can grow his popularity or if it's going to kind of go the direction of most Peruvian presidents and just start to, after 6 months or so, just start to go downward. So he has maybe a little bit of a honeymoon period that he can work with, but if anything, I think he's closer to Evo. I think Evo is actually, a lot of Peruvians like Evo, not just leftists, but especially in southern Peru and in places near Bolivia, they think he did a pretty good job. And you know, he was able to not destroy the economy and bring benefits for a lot of people, and people seem to be happy with him. So I think that would be the model that he'd be more likely to try and copy.
I think there's a trend in the US and the global north more generally to like find tides, like the pink tide, the red tide. And I don't think South America or even Latin America works that way. So I don't like finding these comparisons of which character he would be more like. I would say that Peru has its own background and its own history. So I would look at it in that context. And I could say, okay, there are policies that he is clearly taking out of specific episodes in Venezuela and in Bolivia. I think, for example, his proposal to a new constitution is different from Veronica Mendoza's proposal for a new constitution because it is based on the sectorial election model and replacing Congress with the Constituent Assembly that Maduro proposed. So that I do think there's a parallel with Venezuela that worries me, and I hope that that is abandoned, because I do think it is impossible to do that democratically. I do think there are policies that he will get out of Bolivia. I think he will try to negotiate contracts more than end up filming himself going through the street saying expropriate this and expropriate that. Like, I do think he's going to... So I think he will pick and choose different things from different parts, and the resulting Humpty Dumpty is going to be completely different to anything that we can, you know, generalize from the rest of the continent.
All right, so one more question for you both. So again, Inauguration Day is also Peru's Independence Day. This year it's bicentennial. What are you looking for, you know, in the weeks to come? And maybe cautiously, is there anything you were looking forward to?
I don't know what could happen. It'd be nice if we didn't kind of live so much on the edge here in terms of what's going to be happening and the threat of violence, whether it's from radical protesters kind of getting out of hand. And like we saw last week where there were kind of Fujimori supporters who tried to get into the plaza where the presidential palace is and were trying to tear down gates, and kind of had a little bit of a flare of January 6th to it. But what am I looking for in terms of signs? I guess his first few days in office will be interesting. Who is he going to name? Who is going to be in his government? What are his first statements going to be? Is he going to continue to talk about a new constitution as the most important thing? Is he going to, you know, go directly towards more pragmatic things? Is he going to, the vaccination thing? It'd be nice to see him get vaccinated because he's now of the eligible age. He doesn't seem to have been given an appointment yet, but he could have taken opportunities to do like a public thing where he promotes the vaccine. So I guess I don't really have a clear answer on that, except that it'd be nice to see some sort of political calm after this storm.
So I am very negative in my outlook. I am not an optimist right now. I think we are going to see more political instability. And like I said, I think it's going to be a battle between who can get rid of the other one first, Congress or the president. So on that front, I am very pessimistic. I don't have much hope that the Peruvian right wing and the upper, you know, criollo classes are going to all of a sudden become responsible opposition. I have zero hopes. But if I can offer rather an idealistic, like what I would like to happen, the opportunities that I see that come with every crisis, is that I think Keiko, for example, in 2016 had a unique opportunity to rebrand herself. She could have been the politician that changed the face of Fujimorismo and created this responsible opposition that led Peru out of a pandemic and out of a political crisis and basically shut the mouths of everyone who have been saying that Fujimorismo is exactly what it proved to be, which is an authoritarian, anti-rights, populist party. And she wasted that opportunity, and it's never coming back. I think that ship has sailed. Like, the younger generations that did not live through the Fujimorato are very far away from declaring themselves Fujimoristas. I think Castillo has an equally unique opportunity right now to change the way in which that left is seen. He is right now seen as basically a communist, shining path supporting crazy person that is not qualified to be president. And there is a unique opportunity here for him to focus within a program of reform, within an idea of, okay, let's talk about changing the constitution. Let's have that conversation and eventually change the constitution once I have gained your trust. If he does that, if he's able to change the social structures of the country, if he's able to subvert and challenge this idea that, oh yeah, everything is Lima oriented, if he's able to do big investment in the, I hate the term the provinces, but that's what we call them because we're a super centralist country. If he's able to go to Cusco, to Apurimac, to Ayacucho, and invest there and just give hope to so many people that feel like, oh, it's all about Lima, then eventually he will be able to get people on board for his more quote unquote radical proposals. And I really hope that he has people around him that can tell him this, because from his experience as a union leader, I think he would be qualified to see that opportunity. And I hope that the silence that we're seeing right now from him, where he's not revealing any information about his government, is because he's, you know, weighing all his options and choosing the more statesman option and not the more confrontational option. So that's my hope. I don't think that's going to happen, sadly, but I think it's important to say it often, so that it's out there, that it's people know that it's an option. And so eventually gets to the right ears.
Well, thank you both very much. We are obviously going to be keeping track of both your work and the news in the days and weeks to come.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Karin Zissis. This episode was produced by Katie Hopkins. For more on this year's elections in Latin America, visit as-coa.org/2021. The music in this podcast was recorded at America Society in New York City. For more about upcoming concerts, visit musicoftheamericas.org. We hope you enjoyed this episode. You can help us spread the word. Subscribe, share, and give us a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.